Peter Lardner Smith had completed a degree in electrical engineering at the University of New South Wales and thought the DMR a wonderful place for a young engineer to work. He soon found himself a position on the advisory speed sign project.
Fitted in that vehicle was a primitive avionic device which was measuring the acceleration or the side acceleration, and what in fact it was a glass tube filled with a liquid alcohol, I believe, and with a steel ball in it, and it was a ball bank indicator. And these were actually ball bank indicators out of tiger moss, which had presumably crashed. And the indicator would swing, if the corner was a sharp corner, the ball would swing out to a greater angle, and the operator would record the maximum angle of swing, and that computed to an advised speed appropriate for that corner.
When we thought the ball was at its maximum going around the curve, we would take a photograph of that, and that would photograph the ball bang indicator, giving you that reading and an accurate distance on the speedometer and the speed you were doing and on the odometer. So you knew exactly where you were from your start point. And it would photograph through the windscreen showing you the existing signposting on that curve.
I saw an old gyroscope compass. I bought it and it cost me 5 shillings. We had the odometer, which was going, of course, all the time. But then if you took the compass and read it when you were going in, and then when you went 20 feet or something like that, you'd take the other reading of the compass, and then you'd go another 20 feet and take another reading. And then when you got back reading the information, because you'd have a hell of a lot of film, then you could work out by the change of direction, the distance you travel, you work out what the radius of the curve was. That was one, and I still haven't got my 5 shillings for the compass. All the time I say, when am I going to get my 5 shillings? You know, it's a joke.
One of the things was, of course, it helped to be able to photograph through the windscreen and be sure that the odometer reading you had agreed with where you were supposed to be. So we had to photograph an instrument panel and we had to photograph the road out through the window. So there were two problems. One, outside the window was much further away than the instrument panel, and outside the window was obviously much brighter. So I had this harebrained scheme, and everybody told me it wouldn't work, that we needed to put a supplementary lens in the front of the camera. The bottom half we'd have a close-up lens, and the top half we'd have a light filter, which was great, except that lenses, of course, are circular, and we only had 2 semicircles, one at the bottom and the top. Very bravely bought a fairly high-quality close-up lens, and Carl Rice, one of our draftsmen, went over to Anthony Hordens and said, can you cut that in half for me? And the guy looked at him and said, do you really want this cut in half? And Carl said, just cut it. So he got out his diamond, he cut this thing in half, and then we cut an orange filter in half, mounted the two in front of the camera, and it worked like a dream, really marvellous. And we used that for many years.
We redesigned the curve standards on the basis of human failings, not vehicle failings. And the other thing was the overtaking distance. We started to look at overtaking, and we found the theory of overtaking, which was vehicle acceleration, wasn't necessarily the human's ability to do so. And so my senior draftsman of the day did an experiment, and I had the difficult task of authorising an order for 2 dozen eggs. Because he set up this system of one vehicle overtaking another, and as the overtaking manoeuvre started, he dropped an egg, and when he finished it, he dropped an egg, and they measured the distance between them. And that, I can assure you, despite all the theory in the world, is the basis of overtaking design today.
It's the most unorthodox method I've ever heard of.
Well, it's novel, and when you had no solutions, you invented them.
Another area where standards needed setting was in guideposts and rails. Ken Dobinson.
Guideposts were around from when I joined the DMR. We had big wooden guideposts. And we had protection fencing, which was chain wire fencing. And right at that stage also, we were even using old ferry ropes stretched between posts as guideposts. They rapidly disappeared, thankfully. And we went into protection fencing, and protection fencing was chain wire. If a car got out of control, it got caught by the mesh in the protection fencing, which was fine. But of course, people were starting to develop a thing called guardrail, which is the steel guardrail, and we were trying that out, and it became very successful and became the norm in that period. That was around in the 60s, but there wasn't very much of it. So we developed standards for that, and then we found problems with the standards in that people would run into the ends of the guardrail and do a lot of damage to themselves. So we started to develop processes for protecting the ends and turning them away and putting special devices on, so if you ran into the end of it, you wouldn't kill yourself. And Sasha Dimitri did a lot of work in that particular area.
Our roads, rural roads, in many instances were either long stretch of high speed then followed by substandard geometry. And that change is terribly difficult for drivers to cope. There is a certain process in which you have to understand what is ahead of you to make decision to brake or to control, to reduce the speed or how to guide and so on. So I started introducing chevron hazard markers, reasonably high that you can see them, at night in particular, which are following one after the other, and then you receive information of angular change in your vision to the degree of the curvature so you can adjust your speed.
Since the DMR owned a helicopter, aerial photography was to play an important part in aiding road and intersection design. Ken McCallum was a member of the photographic team.
The aerial photography came about all of a sudden. There was always a need in the Department of Main Roads to have photographs of selected intersections, either for the purposes of design or planning, and even to show vehicle movements, because from the air you could see the rubber on the road showing the tracks that the vehicles left. It was very expensive to buy an aerial camera at the time, and I remember John Limbury, who was my boss at the time, talking about a Wild camera. I think it's Swiss, and there was no way we could ever afford to buy one of those. But he liked dabbling around in army disposal stores, and there just happened to be one in Oxford Street. And he was in there one day and he chanced upon a box that contained what looked like camera gear. And he bought it for a song.
We bought it for £13.10. And I always remember that.
And luckily he found a mount for it, which allowed us to install it into the helicopter, and then it was my job initially to sit in the back with gloves and a scarf and a warm coat, and I would have to hold this camera vertical and do so while ever the person in the front took the photos using an electronic switch. We got some magnificent photos. The lens was very sharp, and with 6-inch negatives, even a 6-foot photo wasn't that much of an enlargement.